Work. What do you think about it? Your job, how do you view it? How do you approach it? One person once said there are three kinds of workers. For example, when a piano is being moved, the first kind gets behind and pushes, the second pulls and guides, and the third just grabs the piano stool. Perhaps you've seen some of those dynamics work themselves out in your workplace. But what's your view? What's your approach to work in general, not just in your workplace, but even the work that you do at your home? Well, as was mentioned a moment ago, we are continuing in our paragraph that began back in Colossians 3:22. It's going through chapter 4, verse 1, the gospel transformed home. And tonight we're looking at verses 22 and 23. I'll explain here in a moment how work ties in here to home life. But just bear in mind, as we work through not only this epistle, but any epistle that Paul is writing, he's addressing various issues that these Christians were dealing with. And so it appears that the Colossians had some struggle in glorifying God in the home, and I imagine that they're not the only ones. In fact, the fact of the matter is all believers have struggled in glorifying God in their given role in the home. And such is the case when it comes to our work life. I've said, as we've gone through this the last few weeks, since the fall, the home naturally unravels and devolves into selfishness by each family member. And so it's only as the redemptive healing of the gospel works its way in the home will each member of the home be transformed into Christ's likeness. It is only as the gospel is applied, for example, that selfish wives will become submissive wives, selfish husbands will be loving husbands, selfish disobedient children will become obedient children, and selfish parents will be nurturing and encouraging parents. Well, thus far we've dealt with two relational pairs. Husbands, wives was the first. The second has been children and parents. And tonight we look at the final pair, masters and slaves or servants. Now, this is included in home life because you've got to understand, in the ancient world, slaves were considered as part of the master's household. And so that's why we're combining this with the idea of the gospel-transformed home life. Now, when I say masters and servants, probably a lot of us immediately feel a disconnect with our passage because, as far as I know, nobody in here is either a master or a slave. But there are some natural applications we'll be able to make tonight in the employee and employer relationship that we find existing today. So that's why I'm going to entitle this sermon, as well as the next, dealing with this particular pair, the gospel-transformed workplace, obedient employees and just employers. Now, before we dive into our exposition here tonight of the two verses we're going to look at and start making applications to our situation today, I think it would be helpful just to get a better handle on historical views concerning work and the workplace. Starting in the ancient view, or the ancient classical view, in other words, Greeks and Romans, they basically viewed work as a curse. It was a necessary evil that people did in order to enjoy leisure in life. In other words, as many people would say today, you work for the weekend. And so there are many remnants of this view that still exist to this day. Another major view that developed during medieval times was the medieval view, and this added a new wrinkle. It added a dichotomy between secular work and sacred work. In essence, what developed, of course, primarily in Europe through the influence of the Roman Catholic Church, was a view that basically said the only really worthy calling in life was full-time ministry, as it were, to become a monk or to become a nun. And basically, any other line of work was considered second rate. You were a second-class Christian, more or less. And so that was the prevailing notion in Romanism. And sadly, I'd say there are remnants of this even in Bible-believing churches to this day. the basic idea is God is more pleased with ministry work than secular work. And I would just say that is a very dangerous notion and unbiblical. That somehow God is not interested in quote-unquote secular employment and how it is carried out as much as he is with missionaries and pastors, etc. That somehow secular work is not a worthy calling. I've heard this stated before by Christians who mean well, and I would stress the word mean well. I've heard statements like this: I work my job in order to support my ministry in the local church. Now, I don't want to be too harsh on the person who says that, because I think there's a tenderness to the local church, a recognition and an appreciation that the ministry of the local church is vital for the Christian's growth, and that a Christian will not grow as he or she should unless the local church is an intimate part of his or her life. So I don't want to be too harsh on the person who says, I work my job in order to support my ministry at the local church. However, I do want to say, I think that statement is unhelpful and diminishes the importance of one's secular work. I think rather than saying that, a more biblical statement would be, I work in order to worship. I work my job in order to worship God. Your work is your ministry. Your work is a key means to your worship. And so we've got to see that wherever God has placed us as a place of God's calling our life to worship Him, whether it's in the home or outside the home. If you are a housewife, for example, that is a high calling from God on your life. Just as important as worship to God in church ministries. Another area is the Renaissance view, and add a little bit different perspective. This actually gave work a little bit more dignity. And the best expressions of this dignity that merged with the Renaissance time would have been the Reformation view, or we could even say the English Puritan view of work, in which both sacred and secular work were seen as worship unto the Lord and a calling from God. And so I would just say, and this is maybe a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, rather than calling, it'd be better for Christians not to call their work a job, but to call it a vocation. Vocation meaning a calling from God. And that's exactly what it is. I think far too many Christians bellyache about their work. I don't enjoy it. I have to do it because it's the only way I survive. My co-workers are horrible. My boss is a tyrant. If this is how you approach your work, I would encourage you to change your tune and start thinking of your work. And I'm not just talking about going to work and then God just only being pleased with you if you witness to a coworker. No, I'm saying going to your work and doing the work as a means of worshiping God. God is being glorified through you actually doing the task of your work. He wants you there. It is your mission to worship Him through your work. So the Reformers did us a great service by recovering a more biblical view of work that had been lost in preceding centuries. A view that broke down the barrier between secular and sacred work that was erected during the Middle Ages, and rightly taught that God is sovereign over all areas of life and wants glory through all areas of life, including our work. The Reformers rightly taught that work is moral and should be done to the glory of God and is sacred. And so whether you go tomorrow to work and you fill out forms, or you have meetings, or you tighten screws or stock shelves, it is a matter of worship as you do those very things. Another historical view that was prominent in the 18th century was the Enlightenment view, which we would say from a biblical perspective wasn't too enlightened. This perverted the God-focused view of the Reformers and shifted it back toward man. The wisdom of man prevailed rather than the wisdom of God. Work became a means in achieving success and wealth. It was man-focused rather than seeing work as a partnership with God and the stewardship of the world. And so humanism acted in the interest of man predominantly, only to achieve that which is in the best interest of man rather than for the glory of God. In the 19th century, we see two competing views pitted against one another: uncontrolled capitalism and Marxism. And both of these systems are flawed because in both systems, sinners are what make them work. In a book entitled Morality in the Marketplace, Brian Griffith states, "The trouble with capitalism is there is no limit to man's greed. And the problem with socialism is that there's no limit to man's desire to control." So these are some of the key views throughout history concerning work. But there's one view I have not mentioned, which is the most important view, God's view of work. And of course, he had a view towards work even before creation, but we see it intersect with humanity in the Garden of Eden, where God ordained work before, and that's important, before the fall ever happened. He ordained work. It is good. God created it as something good, as a good gift from him. I mean, right after creation, God more or less hands Adam a stick and says, start tilling the garden. Start working. In fact, the relationship between man and the ground is so close that there's even a linguistic relationship between man and the ground. In Hebrew, the word for man is Adam, and in Hebrew, the word for ground is Adamah. And it makes sense, right? Because man was formed from the Adamah, from the ground. A good gift, work is. It's meant to be exceptionally fulfilling for us, and it was that before the fall. But after the fall occurred, and the resultant curse came into effect, work became viewed by sinners as something arduous, something laborious and toilsome, something that fallen creatures begrudge. And so let me just ask you here, honestly, tonight, how do you view work? Do you get joy and fulfillment out of your work? Or is it something that you just moan and groan and begrudge? Let me ask you here tonight, if that is the case for you, if you just dread your work, why is that? It's a simple answer. It might sound a little bit insulting, but it's a simple and true answer. It's because you're a sinner. You are a fallen creature. And so, if you really desire to be conformed more to the image of Christ, then you will enjoy your work. That will happen in your life. You think about Jesus Christ. No man ever worked more diligently than he did in that carpenter shop, and no man got more satisfaction out of his diligent work than Jesus Christ did in that carpenter shop. And so if you desire to be conformed to the image of Christ, something radical is going to happen in your life that is totally contrary to the typical worker in the world. As you grow in grace, a reversing of the curse, particularly in this area of work, is going to take place. And you are going to begin to taste some of the enjoyment that Adam got out of his work before the fall happened. And better yet, you're going to begin to get foretastes of work as it will be in paradise restored. Because we will work. We will serve. In our glorified bodies, the image of God that has been disfigured in us because of the fall will be done away with, and we will have a glorified body that will perfectly reflect the image of the second Adam, Jesus Christ, the Creator. And so, as we are being conformed to the image of Christ now, we've got to make sure that we are thinking God's thoughts after Him in terms of our work, that we are not being pressed into the mindset of the world and how it views work. And so what are God's thoughts on this issue of work? Well, let me quickly give you some points of summary that I've kind of already touched on, but let me just summarize them here in these four points. First, understand God Himself is a worker. Genesis 2:1 says, "By the seventh day, God had finished the work He had been doing, and on the seventh day, He rested from all His work." I like what Sinclair Ferguson said on this. He said, "Man was made to work because the God who made him was a working God." The fact of the matter is God continues to work. Jesus makes this clear in John 5:17. Our Lord said, "My Father is always at His work to this very day, and I too am working." So part of God's perfect plan for us is to work. As his image bearers, we are to be workers. Second, and I've already kind of touched on this, understand work is a creation ordinance. Genesis 2:15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to take care of it. So work is part of our stewardship and partnership with God. It is one of the ways in which the divine character is displayed in our lives. Third, you've got to understand, work was marred by the fall. We see this in Genesis 3. Work became to us as sinners something toilsome, burdensome, oftentimes something that seems to be pointless and boring and futile. The preacher in Ecclesiastes 2:11 brings out this point when he says, "Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." And so, because of the fall, humanity's view and approach to work has been twisted. It's been distorted. Unregenerate persons, and indeed even immature Christians, are prone to wrong approaches towards the work. They may be prone towards laziness, idleness, because they view their work as nothing more than something that is pointless and futile. Some people are prone to twist their work by exploiting others. Still more, some are drawn to getting a sense of self-worth and significance out of their work instead of looking to Christ for their significance. And so these are all distortions, ways of twisting the meaning of work. But there is good news, and this is the fourth point I want to make on this. God views work as something that can be redeemed. It is something that can be redeemed. How is that possible? Work can be redeemed because of the work of Christ on the cross. We learned earlier in Colossians, that's the book we're in, yeah. Colossians 1:15 through 21, that Christ is creator, sustainer, and reconciler of all things. He creates them, he sustains them, he redeems them. All things, excuse me, are God's. And because all things are God's, he is very zealous and jealous to make sure that all things glorify him. And if we are his children, we're going to desire to share in that similar passion. And one of the ways in which we're going to seek to glorify him in all things is through our work. So when we grab hold of this, it's going to revolutionize our thinking and approach toward our work. And one of the things that it's going to do, as I mentioned a moment ago, is we're going to start to see our work as a calling from God, as a vocation, not just my job, but my vocation. God in his providence has placed you exactly where you are at, and you need to see it as his present calling on your life. 1 Corinthians 7:17, Paul teaches this. He says, "Each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him." So, is this how you see your work, as a calling? You say, "Well, I don't like my job. It's meaningless. It's pointless." Well, you know, God may move you on from that, but until he does, you need to see it as a high calling from the King of Heaven. Whether you work in the home or outside the home, mothers need to see their calling as a high and holy calling. We who work in the workplace need to see it as a high and holy calling. Children, when mom and dad ask you to do chores around the house, don't go about it with great drudgery, but see it as God's will for your life. Delight that you can do the Savior's bidding as you carry out those tasks that your parents ask you to do. All right, well, that's a basic scriptural framework for work. I want us now to turn our attention to the text, verses 22 and 23, that will give us a further understanding of what it means to be a gospel-transformed employee. And what we see here in these verses is a similar pattern to which we've already seen in the preceding verses. A command is given, and then the reason for following that command. Tonight, we're only going to have the time to look at the two commands, and we see them in verses 22 and 23. We'll have to save the reasons for the commands, and then a treatment of masters, or we would say employers, until the next time that we are in Colossians. So let's first of all start off with the commands for gospel-transformed employees. There are two. The first command, if you look in verse 22, is, slaves, obey your masters in all things. Slaves, and I say slaves because servants here really is too weak of a translation. It's doulos, it's bond slaves. Slaves, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness or in sincerity of heart, fearing God. All right? So pretty straightforward command. Slaves, obey your master. Now, before we get into the parallels and the applications of the slave-master relationship and how it relates to us today as employees and employers, we have to address an issue that we'll just spend a little bit of time on here tonight that I think is a necessary issue to address, because whether we think it's relevant to us or not, I would contend that I think there is some relevance to us here today in regards to this issue of slavery. I mean, it's kind of the giant elephant in the room, isn't it? Something we can't ignore from this passage. The question is the Bible here endorsing slavery? You say, well, this doesn't seem really relevant for us today since it's not much of an issue. But on one level, it is just by virtue that we are Americans. I mean, slavery has been one of these issues that has deeply stained the psyche of Americans, and I would contend even to this day. But there's another issue, and perhaps none of you would raise this objection, but I just want to make you aware of it because it is one that floats out there, even in evangelical circles, and it's the headship of the husband in the home. What do I mean? Well, are you aware that there are many modern theologians today, including some that would bear the label evangelicals, that would say Paul's treatment of the slave and master relationship as a his treatment of that would seem to undo not only slavery, because we know better today, but also wives submitting to their husbands. The basic argument today is we understand that the slave-master relationship is antiquated and morally reprehensible, and therefore the idea that wives should submit themselves to husbands is antiquated and morally reprehensible. The argument continues, Paul's first century cultural bias plays into both kinds of relationships, not only the slave-master relationship, but also the husband-wife relationship. And so the argument goes today by theologians, if we're going to insist that slavery should be abolished, we should likewise insist the abolition of submission of wives unto husbands. Now, I'm bringing these two issues up because I want to, first of all, hopefully show you very quickly that the Bible does not endorse slavery. And at the same time, Paul's treatment here in these verses of slavery does not somehow undo the need for wives to submit themselves unto husbands. So we need to address this issue. Why should we biblically argue for the abolition of slavery while at the same time maintaining the submission of wives? I want to just give you four reasons here. First, we've got to understand, just because Scripture gives instructions for the slave-master relationship, that does not mean it is condoning it. Let me give you an example on a different topic. Matthew 19:8 says, Jesus said unto the Pharisees, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. So there are instructions concerning divorce, but does that somehow mean that God condones that? No. And likewise, just because God, through Paul the Apostle, gives instructions here to the Colossians concerning their situation in slavery does not mean that God is condoning the institution of slavery. What's really going on here is the fact that many of these Christians, not only in Colossae, but indeed in many cities throughout ancient Rome, many of these Christians were slaves, and they had to know how they were to behave as Christians in that situation of slavery. Modern theologian Wayne Grudem gives a very helpful explanation of this when he writes, the Bible does not approve or command slavery any more than it approves or commands persecution of Christians. When the author of Hebrews commends his writers by saying, You joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. That does not mean that the Bible supports the plundering of Christians' property or that it commands theft. It only means that if Christians have their property taken through persecution, they should still rejoice because of their heavenly treasure, which cannot be stolen. Similarly, when the Bible tells slaves to be submissive to their masters, it does not mean that the Bible supports or commands slavery, but only that it tells people who are slaves, how they should respond. A second point I want to make under this is the institution of marriage, and thus the male headship in the home, was ordained of God in the original created order. In other words, it's a creation ordinance before the fall. That's important. An ordinance before the fall, whereas the institution of slavery was not grounded in creation, but was the result of the fall. Let me again quote Grudem here. People who abolished slavery based on an appeal to biblical principles were abolishing something evil that God did not create. But Christians who oppose male headship in marriage and the church are attempting to abolish something good, something that God did create. The examples are simply not parallel. So I hope you can see the difference. Male headship is good because it was created by God. And we even know from the New Testament that it's a good thing and a holy thing because it's even reflected in the relationship between Christ and the church. That is not the case with slavery. Slavery was not a creation of God. It was a creation of depraved and twisted man. Sinners. It's the result of sin. So, in other words, Paul's commands for slavery are only temporary adaptions to a corrupted cultural construct, whereas commands to husbands and wives are permanent commands rooted in creation. If you're taking notes, some passages you could look up for this: 1 Corinthians 11, 8 through 12, 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4, Ephesians 5, 22 and 23 all bear witness to this. Let me give you one example from 1 Timothy 2, 12 and 13. Paul writes, "I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man." Why? Next verse, verse 13. "For Adam was formed first, then Eve." And so the point is it's, again, it's rooted in creation before the fall. Third, and I think this is an important point to make, the seeds for dissolving slavery are sown in the New Testament and specifically by Paul. You know, people want to bash on Paul. A lot of modern liberals or even those that maybe lean that way, even though they bear the label evangelical, a lot of them want to bash Paul as this sort of pig-headed, backward, first-century bigot. But the fact is many of the things that Paul says throughout the New Testament are seeds that would lead people to eventually abolishing slavery. And this makes sense because, again, redemption seeks to reverse all the effects of the fall, which would include slavery. In fact, we have a whole book of the Bible where Paul deals with a runaway slave and his master. Do you know what it is? Philemon. It's the sister epistle to Colossians, actually. And in that epistle, he tells Philemon to not just view Onesimus, this slave, as a slave, but to view him, and here's something absolutely radical in the first century, not to just view him as a slave, but as a brother. And to treat him with kindness and forgiveness, even though Onesimus ran away, and to restore him. That is a radical first century statement that was unheard of. And then Paul makes comments like this in other passages, like Ephesians 6:9, which again are seeds for dissolving slavery. He says, "Masters, do not threaten slaves, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him." As we'll see in chapter 4, verse 1. Of Colossians, "Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." These are radical, radical statements. Fourth, I want to point out, Paul explicitly supports and encourages the possibility of a slave gaining freedom in 1 Corinthians 7:21. The passage states, "If you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity." So I think it is wrong to assume that somehow from these verses in Colossians, I think it's wrong to somehow assume that Paul is endorsing the institution of slavery. I think it's wrong to assume a parallel between the institution of slavery and the institution of marriage and the roles that are within it. Those are just wrong assumptions. There are some people today that kind of get in a little bit of a huff when they look at the apostles like Paul and the other apostles, and they think, well, why didn't these guys take a stronger stand against slavery in their day? Why didn't they call for the immediate overthrow of slavery in their day? I'm going to tell you why, because no one would listen to them. The church was so small in its influence, if people like Paul had gone to the Roman governors or whoever and said, you need to overturn slavery right now, they would have laughed him to scorn. They would have turned a deaf ear. But besides that, and perhaps even more importantly than that, is the fact that God did not call these men to be primarily social activists or social reformers. He called them to be preachers of the gospel. And I think another point that's worth stating is the whole idea of revolt was not even an option. Was not even an option. The fact is, the apostles, under the Holy Spirit's guidance, gave principles that would eventually destroy the institution of slavery. And it's been a horrible scourge throughout the world, and indeed even in our own country. But the fact of the matter is a true understanding of Christianity has the seeds in it that actually destroy that horrible institution. All right, so quickly, back to the question I asked a moment ago. Is the Bible endorsing slavery here? And the answer is no. So then why is Paul addressing these issues? I'm going to tell you why. Because he was writing to real people who had real needs. They were real Christian slaves, and they had to know how to deal with that. The fact is, in ancient times, not only was slavery accepted, but it was considered to be an indispensable institution in any civilized society. In fact, it's estimated that almost half the population of the Roman Empire was comprised of slaves, about 60 million people. They were all over the place, and they nearly did all of the work because the typical free Roman thought it was below his dignity to do work. And so slaves were doing everything. And understand, a lot of these slaves were very well educated. Some of them were doctors and teachers. But like all other slaves, they had to do whatever would bring pleasure and comfort to their masters. In fact, slaves were often spoken of as tools. Tools. And so, for example, if you were a Roman owner and you had a farm, you would talk about your slaves much like you would your plow. And so if you had a plow that broke down, what do you do with the plow? You get rid of it. And that's the same way they would treat their slaves. They were just tools. And so, not only were there many slaves in general, but that would mean there were many Christian slaves as well. And they needed to know how they should behave as Christians in the state of slavery, how they could be distinct, how they could be different than unsaved slaves. How did a person become a slave? Well, they either became a slave by being born to slave parents or through some financial difficulties they had, or by military conquests. They were bought and sold. They had no rights. They were owned as chattel property. They were bond slaves. And it's as bond slaves, Paul tells the Christian ones to obey their masters. It would seem to enslave them some more, but the fact of the matter is it freed them to do as God would have them to do. Obey here is the same verb that was used earlier for children, obeying their parents, present active imperative, which means it was a continuous command to be kept. They were to continually obey their masters. In fact, it says that obedience was to be at all times, in all things, according to the flesh. So whether a slave liked it or not, they were to obey their masters in all things, according to the flesh, meaning obedience did not depend upon the spiritual state of their masters. It didn't matter if their masters was a Christian or a non-Christian. That shouldn't affect the quality of work production by the slave. They should work as hard and as diligent, whether they were a Christian owner or a non-Christian owner. Of course, obedience has its limitations. If a master asked a slave to sin, if he was a Christian, he could not do that. And the verse implies this when it says that this is to be done in the fear of God. And so obviously, as in all things, our highest allegiance is to the Lord. So the command for slaves was to obey. That's the right action. But even as we saw with children obeying their parents, action, right action is not enough. There needs to be a right attitude that accompanies that right action. And we see that displayed here in verse 22. Paul gives the right manner of obedience. He says, slaves, obey. Well, how? Well, don't do it this way. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness, in sincerity of heart, fearing God. So Paul is giving here two ways in which slaves were to obey their masters. One is negative, and it's towards men, and the other is positive, and it's towards God. First, negatively towards men, slaves were to obey, not with eye service, as men pleasers. In other words, slaves, don't just work your hardest and do what you're supposed to do on the job when the boss is watching. But do it at all times. Why? Because God sees you at all times. And that touches on the second manner, and that's a positive one toward God. The command is slaves also obey in this way, in singleness and sincerity of heart, fearing God. Sincerity, the opposite of hypocrisy, the opposite of selfishness and false motives. It is a pure motive. It is done out of great reverence toward God, knowing that God not only sees our outward actions as we perform our task at work, but also He sees our heart in the way that we go about our work. It's a matter of testimony. It's a matter of shining brightly for Christ, not only toward our masters, or we would say today employers, but also towards our employees, fellow employees. Now the second command we see in verse 23. And whatsoever you do, do it heartily, or work heartily, as to the Lord and not unto men. I say work instead of do because that's a better translation. Faithful toiling, faithful laboring is the idea here. And I want to point out four quick features on this, to this work. First, note that the work is all-encompassing. It says, whatsoever you do. And so, no matter how mundane the task may be, the slave was to carry out their work responsibility. Second, it is a work done with total enthusiasm. The adverb heartily there literally is a Greek phrase that means this, out of the soul, from the soul. And so as we do our work, as these slaves were to do in the first century, Christian slaves, they were to do it with a whole heart, a whole soul effort, an energetic, a warm, charged with emotion approach to work, not a cold, not a perfunctory approach to work. Third, it is a work that is done as unto who? The Lord, as opposed to not doing it unto who? To men. Working for men, when it's done the right way, is ultimately a work for God. So let me just say this. No matter what work you may do, you may scrub toilets, but if it's done in this kind of biblical way, it is done with dignity and sacredness unto the Lord, and God is glorified. So let me just spend our remaining moments here by giving you six quick principles for our situation now as Christian employees. This is for us today. First, gospel-transformed employees should obey their employers at all times and in every duty, except if asked to sin. Let me ask you, in your workplace, whether that's in the home or out in the workforce, do you approach all of your tasks with the same vigor? What about the unpleasant task? The task that you consider to be very menial, very routine, very dull, very boring, or perhaps the task that seemed very complex, too confusing. Do you approach those kind of tasks with the same vigor as you do the ones that you enjoy? Or do you take those unpleasant tasks and try to shift them over to someone else? You try to wiggle out of them. Secondly, gospel-transformed employees should work as diligently when the employer is not watching as when he is. You know, usually the longer a person is at a particular job, the more acute he is at understanding when the boss is watching and when he is not watching. When you really have to step up your game and when you can loaf on the job. When you really have to work like a madman and when you can play solitaire on the computer or surf the net or make extended personal phone calls. When things have to be done in order to impress the boss or when you can just chill out. And so we are to work energetically, whether the boss is present or not. One researcher said in a recent study that only 1/4 of employees give their best on the job, and that around 20% of the average worker's time is wasted. Now, oddly enough, in our society, is it not true that if you have a Christian who is actually a hard worker and an honest worker, he can actually get in trouble for that? He can actually be punished for that. His strong work ethic can actually end up exposing the poor work ethic of his fellow laborers, and they can get mad at him. They can lie about him. They can try to take advantage of him. And so what is the believer to do? Is he to slack off? Is he to become dishonest like the rest for fear of losing his job or being passed up for the promotion? What is the Christian to do? He is to obey the Lord in all things. Third, gospel-transformed employees should work with a pure heart, knowing that the Lord examines their heart motives as they work. As you work, you need to work for the glory of God. God knows not only what you are doing outwardly, but He knows your heart attitude as you are doing that work. He knows if there are crooked and ulterior motives going on in your heart. He even knows if you might say, I'm a very hard worker. This sermon does not apply to me. Well, let me ask you, is your industry in work, is your diligence in works for your own glory and your own advancement, or is it for the glory of God? God knows that in your heart. He knows what's going on. Fourth, gospel-transformed employees should do every work responsibility assigned with care. The non-Christian looks at many of his tasks at work as absolutely insignificant, as routine, as menial. But the Christian comes to every task, no matter how small or how apparently insignificant it may be, and he pours eternal significance into the most routine of tasks. Because he realized this is a way to elevate the glory of God. I like what the reformer Martin Luther once said. He says, your work is a very sacred matter. God delights in it. And through it, he wants to bestow his blessings on you. This praise of work should be inscribed on tools, on the forehead, and the faces that sweat from toiling. Fifth, gospel-transformed employees should approach their work with hearty zeal. Christians should be the best workers. They should be the most punctual, the most dependable, the ones full of the most integrity, and with the best attitudes. Christians should never be half-hearted workers, but they should work from the soul. And as they do it, they should enjoy their work, because they realize it is a gift from God given to them. And so, if you find yourself really struggling with that concept, it's because there's a lot of the old nature in you. There's a lot of the flesh that's hanging on you. I should say flesh. Flesh dominating you. Sixth, the last one here, gospel-transformed employees should see their work as a sacred work, ultimately done unto the Lord and not people. You got to understand that as you carry out your work assignments tomorrow and this week, that you're ultimately not working for Hamilton, or Pratt Whitney, or Walmart, or a hospital, or a shipping company, or insurance company, or wherever it is that you work, you are working ultimately for the Lord. Not that company, not those people. The first century Christian slaves had to understand that their ultimate master was the Lord and not the earthly master. It's interesting that the word used for God here is what? It's Lord, which is the Greek word kurios, which means what? Master. He is your master. Your work is a matter of worship. How are you worshiping the Lord through your work? Perhaps you think of your job as meaningless, as menial. I'm just shuffling papers. I'm just filling holes. I'm just tightening screws. I'm just lining up schedules. I'm just collecting money. And you see absolutely nothing that is noble about it. But let me ask you this question. How noble do you think the task were for those first century Christian slaves? I'm going to tell you how meaningful they were. In so much as they did it unto the Lord, those tasks were as meaningful as Paul the Apostle preaching the gospel or writing this inspired letter. That's how meaningful they were. There's no distinction for the Christian between the secular and the sacred when it comes to an honest day's work done for the Lord. And so you've got to see your work as meaningful to God as coming into this place and singing praises unto Him, or preparing a Sunday school lesson for the children, or anything that you do that you think is really hyper-spiritual. You've got to understand, your work is as spiritual and as sacred as those things. It's God's calling on your life, a way that you can glorify Him. And so, what have we done tonight? We've basically discussed Christian slaves having a God-entrenched view of their work, parallel to us today is us having a God-entranced view of our work and our approach to work. Now, here's the irony as we begin to wrap this up. The irony in all of this is Paul is talking to slaves and he's telling them to submit, to obey themselves, obey their masters, submit themselves to their masters. And the irony in all of this is that would seem to enslave them more, but it actually set them free. And what you've got to understand, when you do work according to the way that God is outlining here, for the enjoyment and glorification of God, it's going to set you free as well. You are going to be liberated to do work the way that God has always intended you to do. A gospel view of work sets the Christian free to enjoy His work. But I'm going to tell you, if you approach your work for the wrong reasons, if you approach it for the wrong motives, with the wrong motives, if you're approaching work for approval or for status or achievement or for money or even perhaps just to survive in life, you are approaching work the wrong way and you're going to end up being very frustrated and perhaps even heartbroken. Why? Because many tasks that present themselves to us in the typical day will seem useless for our advancement, or useless in getting us more money. In other words, many tasks in the typical day at work are going to seem useless in achieving our idol. And so work will be disappointing, or it will be nothing more than drudgery to you, because what's going to happen is you're going to find other people in your workplace that are far better at promoting themselves than you, and they're going to get the promotion and you're not. And if you are approaching your work only for status and achievement and significance, you're going to be shattered, because your idol, you're not getting your idol. But if instead we have Christ's salvation and He is the source of our significance and our security, then all the other motives will lose their hold on us. They'll no longer enslave us. If we begin, as Paul says here, to work unto the Lord, we will be freed from both extremes. We'll be freed both from overwork and be freed from underwork. We'll be freed from the wrong desire to find significance and acclaim through our work and thus become a workaholic. Or if we're on the other extreme, we'll be freed from laziness because we see our work as meaningless. We'll be freed from both of those extremes because we will see our work as a way to glorify and worship our God. Work will no longer become a grinding necessity in our life for survival, nor will it be the pathway to self-fulfillment and self-worth. It will be a way in which we please God and spread the fame of His name throughout the world, starting in our workplace. So here's the irony. I'll state it one more time. The irony for the Christian employee when they submit themselves, obey their employers, rather than enslaving themselves, they end up liberating themselves. And so feel liberated tonight. And as you go to your workplace this week, work heartily as unto the Lord, knowing that He is getting glory as you perform the task that He has called you to perform this week. Let's pray.